theme of today's seminar was liberal arts in the context of liberal economics. And that does suggest that perhaps the first issue to address is the meaning of the word liberal. Because evidently this is not self-evident from those two terms, nor indeed is it self-evident in the wider political and cultural world. Without even going into the various interconnections and self-examinations that is going on across the river about the meaning of the word liberal, it's interesting to see just how varied its use is within the church. The semantic range extending from roughly satanic to self-evidently correct. But if we were to try and unscramble a little bit what the meaning of the word is in these particular contexts, we might find some suggestive outcomes. Suggestive outcomes, but not immediately very coherent ones. Because traditionally, the way in which the word liberal has been used in the context of liberal arts is very much in the sense of a kind of study, a kind of intellectual enterprise, which is not immediately about what classical philosophers would have called technique, how to do things. Liberal arts has been historically the preserve of those who want to think about issues other than the mechanics of getting certain effects secured. Or, to put it in one word, liberal arts has been seen as anti-functionalist. It's claimed that there is a legitimate area of intellectual life which is not always to be measured by the immediate practical results, but is to be measured by some sense of the enlargement of the intellectual capacity, the exercise of the mind for the sake of its own dignity. That presupposes a number of things, notably, I think, a certain practice of education, which I'd call broadly conversational. That's to say, a practice of education in which what is said generates further questioning, further problems. What is actually said becomes the agenda of the next round of intellectual reflection. There is no simple closure in this area, the kind of closure that might be arrived at if the whole point is simply to make something work more obviously effectively. And if we say that the practice of the liberal arts in this sense is conversational, we're saying, of course, that it's also, in a way, comical. Because you need somebody else to ask the questions that will prompt you to say something that will prompt them to ask more questions, there is inevitably an element of cooperation about this. And while academics in the historic liberal arts areas are not always temperamentally or naturally cooperative than any other kind of academic, nonetheless, there is something about the practice taken for granted which assumes that the discourse goes on. Some of the most interesting reflections on liberal arts in the literature of the last quarter century or so you'll find in the novels of David Lodge. And those of you who've read Small World will remember the explosive question in the seminar at the end of the book: what follows if everyone agrees with you? A question which not only reduces a whole raft of panelists in an international literary critical symposium to silence, but re-energizes one of the great scholars of the world who has had nothing to say for the past 20 years or so. What follows if everyone agrees with you is, of course, the end of the discipline. And in the humanities, I think we could reasonably say that universal agreement would be the universal dullness that Alexander Pope supposed would follow at the end of the collapse of the arts and the intellect. Universal dullness varies all. Now, to put it in that way is not, of course, to deny that the natural sciences are conversational, or to ascribe to the sciences an obsession with closure and with simple answers and so forth. That is a caricature. But I think that what a voice from the humanities would probably want to say about this is that sciences are at their best and their most creative when they too are not the prisoners of functionalism, and when they too build in a conversational practice that allows creative disagreement. In other words, liberal, in the term liberal arts, suggests something corporate, something shared. And here's the paradox, because liberal, in liberal economics, has come to be associated with a highly individualistic style of approach to human affairs. Liberal economics, I suppose, gets its name from the idea that the withdrawal of control and regulation is the way to an efficient, self-balancing world of self-interests carefully negotiating with one another. It presupposes that self-interest is where you start and ideally where you finish, even if on the way you may have gone through an interesting negotiating process. But the point I'm making is that the assumption coded in the language of liberal economics about liberalism is rather different. I didn't think you would say liberal economics, as we've learned to understand it, that it's essentially a conversational practice. I'm not at all sure that you would say that its goods were intrinsically shared goods, as opposed to the careful balancing of individual goods. It may well be accepted, then, that in our current environment, the role of liberal arts in an environment of liberal economics is not going to be all that straightforward. And yet, both kinds of liberal enterprise have had a little bit of a shock in the last couple of decades. Liberal economics can no longer, I think, just be described as the prevailing orthodoxy. The last few years have shown that unregulated trust in markets to do their own business with common sense has not been a very common sense assumption. Equally, the notion of liberal arts as a conversational practice has been challenged quite properly by those who say, what, humanly speaking, is the outcome of this kind of discourse, this kind of conversation? Does it, in any interesting sense, equip people for citizenship, for civic virtue and civic exercise? It was an essay written a few years ago by somebody in higher education who said that the connection of the university world with civic virtue and citizenship was one of the lost treasures, so to speak, of early modern and high modern educational practice. We needed to make the connections again in some way. It's a difficult line to tread. If liberal arts are able to be themselves, that is, to deal with questions that are not just about techne, not just about function, then we can't specify their outcome, or their usefulness, or their impact, to use that sinister contemporary word, too closely. And yet to say that there is no outcome in terms of human flourishing or human good would be a little bit strange. How do we draw out that set of implications about human good more clearly? So, in talking about the liberal arts in the environment of liberal economics, granted the extremes with which I've begun in terms of defining the word liberal, it does seem that there is room for a conversation precisely between those ends of the spectrum as they are forced to get more closely towards one another. And the territory on which that conversation, possibly that convergence, comes is very much the territory about the nature of what is corporately good for us. Even 10 years ago, to ask what's good for us as a social question would have been quite difficult. All of a sudden now, all kinds of people are talking about virtue and common good. And even in the somewhat tangled and not always very clear language of the big society, we see a concern to make the connections between the life of the mind and the welfare of the heart and the convergent good of human beings as such. We have understood that if we're talking about growth as an economic and social concept, we can't wholly divorce it from well-being. We've begun to understand that wealth in the abstract, divorced from well-faring, is not only a fiction, but a really damaging, corrosive fiction, which leaves in its wake a great trail of human suffering and the corruption of mind and imagination. We perhaps not register that as fully and as deeply as we need to. There are still those who talk about business as usual, meaning a return to those corrosive practices as soon as is possible. In the meantime, though, we have a little bit of a window of opportunity where, since those questions are on the table, we can pick them up. And the liberal arts have something to say about how those questions might be picked up, where they might be taken. Now, it's in the nature of the humanities, the liberalism of the humanities, that they don't deal with finished resolutions, signed, sealed, completed kinds of discourse. They keep alive certain questions. And that means that we can't look to the humanities, not even to theology, for answers that will settle those questions of well-being, good, happiness, straight away. But it helps us to be aware of those traditions that over the centuries and millennia have worked at clarifying for us, as you might put it, what kind of question is a moral question? What kind of question is a question about well-being? Where do you really have to have an anthropology, a doctrine of human nature, in order to go on talking and thinking? And it's that area of anthropology, in the broadest possible sense, that I think the humanities, very properly given their designation, address themselves to. We are a bit more aware that there are questions which you cannot intelligently talk about unless you have a sense of what human well-being is like. You may want to argue about the detail of it. You may want to oppose very strongly certain conclusions that might be drawn. But you need at least to know what sort of question is being raised. And that, I believe, is very near the heart of the role of the humanities in general in a time when liberal economics is having a bit of a crisis of conscience. It's a role focused on helping people to see where those areas are in which you need to have a sense of human well-being. A sharp-edged sense of what is good and what is not good for human beings as such. A sense, for example, that allows you to say human beings do not, in fact, discover their good simply by examining their immediate wants. You might say it's a sense that the corporate good of humanity is not something that can be abstracted from humanity's embeddedness in the natural order, the material. You might want to say that it's something to do with the context in which there is no systematic organizational suppression of the voice of any community or class or genre of persons. You might want to say it's something to do with democracy, in fact, not in the rather cheapened sense in which we fling the world around quite often, but in the sense of what it might take to secure a social environment in which people's voices be guaranteed a hearing in exactly that open-ended debate which we spoke of. So the role of the humanities and the liberal arts is to deploy into social, political, and economic discussion those enormous, very varied, chaotically varied traditions of thinking about the human good represented by philosophy, by history, by the literary disciplines, and of course by theology. And I want to offer not quite a digression, but let's just call it an extended parenthesis about where theology fits in here. Theology, it's been said, is about reading, by which I don't just mean that you can't pass an exam in theology without reading at least a couple of books. Theology looks back to a religious practice which is very much about texts, reading and rereading texts. It's about reading a book which you know has been read by someone before you. It's about reading someone else's reading. It's about reading a world and a biography in terms of the reading of a text and other people's readings of a text. For Christian theology, right at the centre of the enterprise is one of the most audacious acts of rereading that there has ever been in the cultural history of religion. That is the rereading of Hebrew scripture as part of a larger story. The rereading that's going on in what Christians call the New Testament. So we should not exactly be surprised if texts feature largely in the study of theology. And that rereading, that attention to other people's reading, that sense of reading an environment in terms of a text and the other way around, all of that presupposes a center, a notion of human well-being, human good, which in effect says to be fully human is to know how to listen. To be fully human is to know how to receive, not merely how to act or how to choose, but how to absorb and respond and grow. How to receive a gift. And the notion of gift is, of course, crucial in all kinds of theological and philosophical reflection, just at the moment. If theology has something to bring from among the humanities to the sort of debate I've just been outlining, surely what theology brings is something like that picture of the human good, human flourishing, as bound up with a listening skill. Famously, the rule of St. Benedict begins with the single, abrupt Latin word, ascolta. That's best rendered in modern American English as listen up. And the virtue of the Benedictine life is a very particular instantiation of the virtue of Christian life as a life in which the skills of listening, receiving, responding are crucial. So that in a cultural environment where listening, receiving, and responding are not always very deeply privileged, let's say, where the will to assert that your voice be heard, never mind anyone else's voice, sometimes seems to be favoured, there's really rather a lot that theology has to offer as a practice of reading, a practice of listening to the reading of others, a practice of reflecting on what it is to respond. Invitation, a word from elsewhere. Whether or not we persuade our culture that the word from elsewhere is not simply an echo of what happens in the world, but an initiative quite outside the universe, nonetheless, we should have done some of our job simply by persuading our culture to take listening a bit more seriously. It's a very particular form of the conversational virtue that I ascribe to the humanities more generally. Because, of course, a good conversation is not simply a pair of people, each of whom is waiting for the other one to shut up so that they can say what they want to say. Conversation is created in the listening, in the openness. It doesn't mean that anything can be said. It doesn't mean that everything is equally intelligible. Means that understanding It's a time-bound business in which relationship and trust and the long-term perspective matter enormously. Theology has something to say about what it's like to know things. So often, we are sold a view of what real knowledge is in our culture, which supposes that knowledge has a lot of items out there which can be later along internalized, processed, and utilized. Theology, again, among the humanities, says knowledge is a much slower process, a much more intuitive and trustful process, and one which never allows you to say you have possessed what is to be known. Theology in particular speaks of an object of true and real knowledge which will never be possessed or fully understood, for the understanding of which we need quite literally infinite time. We should only understand God at the far end of infinite time, and therefore we shan't understand God. Well, that's my parenthesis about theology among the humanities. But I hope you may see why I want to locate theology very much in the conversational practice of the liberal arts, to associate it with the conversational style, the open work of the internet that's involved there. The fact that theology deals with texts and traditions is no more a sign that it is bound to foregone conclusions than the fact that any of the other humanities deal with texts and traditions. These are ways, as I said earlier, of drawing on an extraordinarily rich and varied heritage in order to bring into a steadily growing space of public argument at the moment considerations about the human good, which are not simply about a short-term definition of effectiveness, effective function, but have to do, ultimately, with the possibility of seeing oneself and therefore one's neighbour rather differently. So, really, what I'm suggesting is that the humanities, the liberal arts, properly understood, are a study that leads to happiness. Don't ask undergraduates immediately for their views on this, especially not those who are about to sit first-year Greek examinations. Yet, it's clear, should be clear, that the reflection on what it is that shapes your expectations of the human has to be about your sense of well-being, has to be, therefore, about your own well-being at the end of the day. Our task and our challenge in the present economic and cultural climate is to persuade a sceptical but not completely hostile public that effective function, if we think we know what it means, is a rather dangerous principle on which to work. What does it mean to function well as a citizen, let's say? I think that a student of the humanities in general, or perhaps of theology in particular, would say to function effectively as a citizen means to recognise that you are not just a citizen, ever. But to function effectively in any number of practical contexts, you need to be more than a functioner or functionary. So the effectiveness criteria can almost dismantle itself. If you look at the work of some of the most interesting sociologists and reflectors on our economic situation at the moment, writers like Richard Sennett and Michael Sandel, you'll see there more and more clearly coming through the sense of the dysfunctionality of functionalism. The more you assume that the citizen, the worker, the employee, works best when treated solely as functionary, the more, in fact, you cripple, shrink, and disempower individual and community. put it another way, no human enterprise functions without imagination. That is, without the sense that the questions currently being put and the answers currently being heard are not necessarily the only ones. Imagination simply says, this could be different. The legacy of the liberal arts must be to question the questions in that way. You could think of this differently. And that, as I hinted earlier, that is why the sciences themselves can never be functionalist if they are to be dynamic in their practice. And every sensible scientist I've ever come across would agree with that, even Professor Dawkins. This means that those of us gathered here today have quite a task in front of us, a task of apologetic and persuasion. Not directly apologetic for the Christian faith, but that's always a good idea, but apologetic for what my great predecessor Sir Michael Ramsay called Christian humanism. That's to say, the sense that our theological inheritance is one which asks necessary, life-giving questions of where we are. The prospects for theology in particular and humanities in general in the world of higher education at the moment are not at their most rosy. That certainly came through very clearly in our discussion this morning. Because those who want short-term assessments of impact and effectiveness are always going to be pressing the humanities to produce what it's not really their nature to produce, and are always tempted to sideline the questions of happiness or well-being or the shared good, which I've touched upon in these remarks. So our job is not simply to carry forward an argument within the institutions of higher education with which we're involved, crucial as that is. It's also to go on waging what for once is, I think, an entirely appropriate form of culture war. Most culture wars are unpleasant and rather squalid standoffs between different sorts of bigot. But this particular kind of culture war, I would say, is more like a war for the very notion of culture. That is, imaginative and argumentative democracy. A three-dimensional picture of the human. A sense that we are most effectively citizens when we are not only citizens, we are most effectively political when we are not only politicians, and even that we're most successful at our economics when we're not only economists, dealing with that remarkable 19th century myth, the homo economicus, the rationally calculating economic subject, whose rational calculations brought us to such an interesting position in recent years. It's a cultural question. It's a public question. It's a question that can be asked, raised in any number of settings, including the church. And I don't believe that we shall begin to address the concerns, the crises that face theological education, without some of that wider cultural concern with what we mean by education and formation for any human being, for any citizen. Without that, we simply become another self-interest group. But if we're prepared to make those connections in the way that those connections were being made in our discussion this morning, then I believe we might be seen as having an authentic contribution to make to an ongoing public debate. As I said, we have a window of opportunity. Something has opened up. And, as was said this morning, we are facing a possible future in which the openness of students in non-humanities subjects to elements of the humanities being introduced into their courses as part of a general concern for citizenship gives us some openings which we ought to be keen to take advantage of. I hope we shall. And I hope that as that happens, the very notion of knowledge begins to shift. As I said earlier, I think we are so often hypnotized by ideas of what constitutes hard or soft sorts of knowing, hard or soft kinds of discipline. We need to explore that. We can only do that if we have a humanist view of knowledge with its roots in the humanities and in the history of science. Because I would say that the history of science is a particularly fascinating area to the extent that you can't simply say this is about science or this is about the humanities. You can't simply say this is about how we learned how to do things the proper way. And those of you who read Richard Holmes's lovely book on 18th century science a couple of years ago, The Age of Wonder, will perhaps recall how there the interweaving of scientific development in the 18th century with the growth of the Romantic movement was placed in the centre of the argument. Science does not come from nowhere, and the best scientist, like the best citizen, the best politician, the best economist, is best when not solely the scientist. So that's the very broad setting in which I want to place this discussion of liberal arts, liberal economics. Beginning with those ideal types and those very different senses of what the word liberal might mean, we can see where convergence may yet occur. And we can see that while at present our situation is horribly constrained and the threats of trivialization, functionalization in higher education are very real, nonetheless, we have every reason and every resource for mounting a robust reply. A reply which says, we have something to say about happiness, about well-being in the public sphere. We have something to say about the questions which properly unsettle premature answers and corporate self-satisfaction. Something to say about democracy. Something to say about trust. Something to say about knowledge. And theology, in the wake of all this, perhaps clears its throat a little bit nervously and says, perhaps we have something to say about faith, something to say about God. And that unless we say that and have the liberty to say it, actually humanity itself will not last very long or very well.